Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but...
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the Solartopia song, Grammy-winning Solartopia song from the wonderful Pete Seeger, written by David Burns, verses by David Burns, sung with the gorgeous Dar Williams. We just had the Grammys, and that song won one. Many years back, not so many years back, I guess, it was on the Rivertown Kids album, won a Grammy. I'm still waiting for mine in my mail. I don't think it's coming in the near term, but it's fun to say that won a Grammy, and it will win a Green Powered Earth. That's what we really are counting on. We have a wonderful show today, two great activists. Terry Lodge from Northern Ohio will be, Northwestern Ohio will be with us for the first half hour, along with Kevin Camps. The great activist from Beyond Nuclear in Washington, D.C., and we are going to talk about what I would have to say is the world's most dangerous nuke. That's quite a distinction among the 350 or 60 still operating outside of Japan in this world. The Davis-Bessie reactor near Toledo, east of Toledo, west of Cleveland, which I can't even begin to describe how bad this reactor is. If an anti-nuclear activist made up the actual specifications and history of Davis-Bessie, we would be considered conspiracy theorists and simply not credible. But the realities of Davis-Bessie are just staggering. Terry Lodge lives in the shadow of Davis-Bessie, and Kevin Camps, a Kalamazoo boy, has been on the case for many, many years. So we are going to talk about shutting this thing down, which is an imminent possibility. And I have been spending a lot of time lately out in California at Diablo Canyon. I have two grandsons in Los Angeles, downwind of that thing. But I also live in Columbus, Ohio, which is also downwind of Davis-Bessie. So these are and reactors are of particular interest to me, but I believe that actually a decision is imminent or within the next 6 months on Davis-Bessie that could shut the thing down. So Terry Lodge, you're with us, right?
Yes, indeed.
All right, Terry. So you're out there in scenic northwestern Ohio, and you have been fighting the Davis-Bessie reactor along with Kevin. Kevin Camps, you're with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
You are in Washington, D.C., the belly of the beast, at the great Beyond Nuclear organization. So let's give this the platform to Terry. Terry, can you, to start here, Terry, can you describe the astounding history of the Davis-Bessie nuclear plant? I know that many of our listeners will think you're making it up, but a little duck will come down if you exaggerate something. But tell us this clone of Three Mile Island. Tell us the history of the Davis-Bessie nuclear plant just a few minutes so we can proceed.
Hope there's no way. I can tell you this much. First of all, I want to apologize. If you hear any barking in the background at some of the young associates here at my law firm having some debate over policy, food policy, I think. Anyway, I have several rescue dogs, is what I'm telling you.
Oh, I see. Well, if you hear some beeping going off in the background, it's because my rice cooker is about to go off, and I'll switch rooms. But it does.
So, anyway,
all right, go ahead.
The short history of Davis-Bessie could never be short. I will hit a few of the high points, starting in 1977, when operating at 9% power, the reactor started to presage the Three Mile Island accident. A smart new reactor operator picked up on what was happening and manually intervened, shut the thing down. It was only operating, as I say, at 9% power, So thankfully, things were not going to spiral out of control for a few additional seconds than they had to respond to Davis at Three Mile Island.
So you're saying that a young, a novice reactor operator at Davis Bessie saved the Great Lakes from Chernobyl? Is that what you're telling us?
That's what I'm telling you. And pardon me.
Do we have this person's name? Do you know the name of this person?
No, I don't know the name. It's been lost in the nearly 40 years between that point and now. However, he did attempt to bring to the attention of the NRC, and the NRC inspector on site attempted to bring to the attention of his superiors, and an engineer at Babcock Wilcox, the builder and manufacturer of most of the reactor parts and components. That engineer also attempted within Babcock and Wilcox to warn that the then seven other sister or brother reactor styles to Davis Bessie could fall subject to the same problem. The engineer was fired. The NRC inspector was effectively blackballed and sent to the NRC equivalent of Siberia. King of Prussia.
Oh, yeah, King of Prussia, right.
Yeah, I think he was left to monitor plutonium that would later turn up missing. I don't know.
And, of course, Davis Bessie is a sibling of Three Mile Island. And it's my understanding that the owners of Three Mile Island later sued the owners of Davis Bessie for not revealing what had happened at Davis Bessie on the presumption that it could have helped them avoid the accident at Three Mile Island. Is that correct?
Well, it's somewhat correct. They also sued the NRC, claiming, imagine this, asserting that the NRC had under-regulated them, had not done a diligent enough job of troubleshooting and figuring out that we could have all kinds of problems with this reactor type and not telling them adequately. And it ultimately got this boost on sovereignty in the ground.
So, that's almost a joke. To hear that a utility sued the NRC for not sufficiently regulating them, when we know that every inch of the way the utilities resist any form of regulation at all, I like that. That should be a good punchline on a sitcom.
Yes, and for the last quarter century, the deregulation has been manifest and ongoing and obvious. The wholesale move to self-regulation, self-reporting by nuclear utilities is incredible, as the industry has, of course, long since entered the bathtub failure cycle. Things are rusting and getting old and cracking and are out of date and that sort of thing, and we're relying more than ever on the utilities' ability to put public health and safety over profit. So
right, I think you get it. So then Davis Bessie avoids this barely avoids this major catastrophe.
Yes. They dodge the bullet, and then for the next approximately 4 to 5 years, Davis Bessie is ranked among the then approximately 110 reactors in the world as about third or fourth from the lowest in terms of capacity factor and reliability. In other words, there were maybe two or three reactors in the world that were operating less efficiently and less satisfactorily. Also, I might add that very oddly, in the story that emerged briefly and disappeared, in about 1980 or 81, two reactor operators within a space of 4 to 6 months were diagnosed with testicular cancer, which is considered and had been even at the time considered to be an occupational hazard of the routine radiation exposures at nuclear power plants. In June 9th, 1985, on June 9th, 1985, there was a remarkable near miss at Davis Bessie involving the. Well, it ultimately involved the reactor starting to run out of control, and when the operators tried to ensure that there was available water to inject under high pressure into the reactor should it overheat, they discovered that there were several valves that had been manually chain locked so that they could not open. And the NRC, the official NRC lessons learned report from that time, it read like a novel. It was just amazing. It described sweaty engineers and operators rushing down darkened hallways into sort of the cavernous areas of the reactor building, trying to unlock or otherwise unshackle the valves. Pretty amazing.
Wait. What was the rationale for manually locking these valves? Did they have their bicycles locked to them, or what's the deal?
From what I recall and understand, there was concern that people would accidentally open them, and I think in one instance the valve was pretty leaky, and people would attempt to adjust it, screw it up worse, so somebody in exasperation simply locked it so it could not be turned.
Kevin Camps in Washington, is there anything you want to add to this madcap adventure as Terry takes us down the memory lane here at Davis-Bessey?
Yeah, well, as I got more involved with Davis-Bessey back around 2002 because of the hole-in-the-head fiasco, that was the lid corrosion, Terry told me a lot of these stories, you know, and there were so many near misses at Davis-Bessey that I couldn't keep track of them all because they overlapped and they blurred. So I finally, when we went to challenge the 20-year license extension, that was back in late 2010, I just had to write this all up just to get it straight in my own head. So we actually posted this backgrounder at Beyond Nuclear's website. It's called Radioactive Russian Roulette at Davis-Bessey. And, you know, the list just keeps going. And one of my favorite memories that kind of encapsulates it for me was I was in Kiev, Ukraine in April of 2006. It was the 20th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear catastrophe. And NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, played a big role in organizing a shadow conference across the street from the pro-nuclear, you know, whitewash, the International Atomic Energy Agency 20th commemoration. And I was sitting there listening to a Chernobyl nuclear power plant whistleblower, and he was either speaking in Ukrainian or Russian language, and we had these headsets where you could get real-time translation in English. And I heard him say Davis-Bessey before what he was talking about got translated, so that got my attention. What he was talking about was, yeah, I've told you all this stuff about how bad Chernobyl is, how bad the RBMK Soviet-style reactor is, and there were still some operating at that time, I think, in Lithuania. But he said, let me tell you, it's not just Russian reactors. Let me tell you about this American reactor called Davis-Bessey, you know? I was floored. I just about fell out of my chair. And he went through a lot of these stories of the near misses, but the culmination was, you know, 6 inches of the lid getting eaten away by boric acid, leaving 3/16 of an inch of stainless steel liner that was bulging and soon to burst. It was the nearest thing to a meltdown situation since Three Mile Island in 1979, right? And it happened in 2002, and NRC's fingerprints, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, were all over this thing. At the commissioner's level, the chairman, Richard Meserve, also senior management level, people like Sam Collins, who got a promotion out of the deal. So, you know, they have had some very near misses at Davis-Bessey.
So let me tell you, do you guys have circus music that you play when you present this stuff in public, you know, just to like liven it up?
We usually dress up as characters from The Simpsons just for comic relief because, you know, just for sanity's sake.
Well, Terry Lodge, how far from Davis-Bessey do you live? Terry, you still there?
Yes, sorry. I live about 45 miles west. So upwind, but you know, we all live downwind. I mean, the wind doesn't uniformly blow one direction.
Let me ask you, you stopped the last little fiasco that you mentioned that Davis-Bessey was in the 80s. What else happened between then, before the big hole in the head that Kevin Camps mentioned that everybody knows about? Are there any other major, Keystone Cop-worthy incidents worth mentioning?
Yes. In 1999, I believe, there was a tornado that grazed the plant, but chewed up nearby on-site interface with the grid, the various hardware interconnections with that deliver power to the grid as well as receive power from the grid. Since that was chewed up, it disconnected the plant from the electrical transmission grid, and the plant shut down, but the scheme was that there would be power that would be coming from off-site to continue to operate cooling pumps and basically maintain the safety systems and all that. So what happened was that there are two gigantic diesel engine-powered generators that are maintained on-site, or maybe not maintained, but they're kept on-site. One of them refused to start at all. The second one created a great deal of concern as it continued to nearly fire up but not quite ignite, and until it finally did. I think Kevin knows a little bit more of the details of that. But once again, it was a situation where the MRC gives a low-grade citation to the utility for not periodically testing the performance capabilities of the diesel generators, which are vital.
When they want these generators to start up, do they have guys who have to run out and crank the thing, you know, like on those old cars?
Correct. Yes. Yes. Okay. And there was a history. There was a history streaming down through the 80s into the 90s of these engines not firing very capably. Part of it, just as with your car, an internal combustion engine has to be fairly frequently turned over, and they were just simply not doing it often enough. And they weren't. And what you have, especially with diesel fuel, is that it clogs. It creates all kinds of problems at the carburation stage. So, really,
so they were without off-site power.
Yes.
Yeah, they were without off-site power for a couple days. And what's really remarkable is the second diesel that Terry described kept breaking down, and they'd have to fix it. So David Lockbaum at Union of Concerned Scientists pretty much said, through the heroic efforts of the personnel at Davis-Bessey, whoever was fixing that second diesel, because the first one was down for the count, you know, they saved Northern Ohio. What's really remarkable is that the grid was, you know, that the repair workers on the grid were working furiously to try to get the grid back into Davis-Bessey. They restored the grid to Davis-Bessey about an hour before that second and last diesel gave up the ghost. So that is how close we came to a Fukushima-like situation at Davis-Bessey, because you got to cool the core for days after it shuts down.
So now we've had one close call where we were saved by a novice operator who caught a Three Mile Island in progress. Then we have another heroic group who saved us, Northern Ohio again, by getting this the grid restored. What happens next?
Well, I think something to keep in mind through all of these crazy stories is this whole time, it's very likely, and even the company admits it, that the shield building, which is the concrete containment at Davis-Bessey, the ultimate last defense against a catastrophic release of radioactivity, was severely cracked. They say that the severe cracking first originated in January of 1978. They blame it on the blizzard of 1978, and we call that the snow job of 2012 when they came up with the excuse, because there's multiple root causes of the cracking. There's multiple forms of cracking. But if that's true, and it probably is, that the blizzard did some damage to the shield building, they had a compromised containment through a lot of these near misses we're talking about. So if any of these near misses had gone all the way, the containment was not going to stop the radioactivity. So that's another thing to bear in mind.
Well, I have heard that the company has defended themselves by saying that they used top quality cardboard to build this containment building, and that they're not really responsible.
Man, because we've intervened against the 20-year license extension, we've been, you know, pouring through these voluminous documents, and we've turned up stuff that nobody knew before. Like, for example, they said the blizzard of January 1978 caused the cracking. Well, we documented in their own documents, company documents and Nuclear Regulatory Commission documents, the first cracking that's documented was in August of 1976, pre-blizzard. So they've been screwing up at Davis Bessie and keeping secrets, you know, pre-operations. Another
Terry,
one that
Terry
we...
Lodge, Terry Lodge, yes, do we know what caused the, might have caused the cracking in 76?
Well, what it would certainly appear to be is that they left the building standing open without a completed roof on it for several years, I think about 3 years.
Why?
After it was going through the tree, yes. Yes, indeed. And, in fact, some of the cracking in 76 was identified in the roof structure of the building. This is a approximately 200-foot high cylinder, weighs somewhere we've estimated in the vicinity of 22,000 to 26,000 tons of poured concrete into a latticework of rebar, of iron. And one of the problems with that is that and you will recall the Romans have still, there are still Roman-built things a couple thousand years later that are made of concrete, but they didn't use rebar. The problem with rebar is once it starts getting wet and corroded, it actually expands and it promotes cracking, which is certainly a piece of the cracking phenomenon going on at the cylinder, the shield building at Davis Bessie. One of the things we've just learned in the last couple of weeks is that if you were to look at this upright cylinder and circumscribe it in 25-foot wide bands, B-A-N-D-S, in other words, it would be about 8 bands, and if you came down to the from the top to the second band, in other words, from about 25 to 50 feet from the top of the shield building, the NRC, pardon me, First Energy, has now acknowledged in the last couple of weeks that about 70% of that band, that 25-foot swath of the reactor, the entire circumference of it, 70% of that has cracking in it. The 25 to 50-foot band below it is 20% cracked. What's really kind of remarkable is that we're talking about the sort of cracking that the Regulatory Commission engineers estimated in 2011 that if the shield building were subjected to a minor, i.e. less than 4.0 earthquake, or a heat transient event inside the shield building where the reactor was burning, was fissioning a little bit hot, that either of those events could cause crumbling of the shield building. They estimated crumbling of the 30-inch thick shield building walls up to 90% of their depth, leaving 3 inches of concrete left.
Well, that's reassuring. At least it would be 10% left.
Yes.
Is it possible? Well, here's a scenario. What if fracking, which is being done in Ohio, and it's causing earthquakes all over the country, thanks to fracking, Oklahoma now has more seismic activity in California. What if fracking caused an earthquake in northern Ohio? Could that bring down the Davis Bessie reactor?
Well, we could possibly contact a bookie in Las Vegas and getting a clock. I think, Harvey, that you also have to remember that in a week before Perry, the Perry Nuclear Power Plant, which is near Mentor, Ohio, up east of Cleveland, along
well,
the way.
35 miles east of Cleveland.
Yeah. Well, in 1986, the week before it went online, there was a minor earthquake a few miles offshore that almost tested it to its seismic maximum. And so there are earthquakes in this part of the country, whether or not they are induced by fracking, which certainly doesn't help the whole situation.
Well, to show how on top of earthquakes from fracking First Energy is, they're allowing, I guess you could say, they're not the only ones allowing it, but there is fracking taking place within a quarter mile of First Energy's Beaver Valley nuclear power plant in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, which is the location of the first civilian atomic reactor in the country, Shippingport, 1957, but they've got two full-size, so-called modern atomic reactors there, and they've got fracking in the immediate vicinity. So that's how concerned First Energy is about, you know, putting these multiple bullets in the radioactive Russian roulette gun.
Well, I am tempted, but I'm gonna defer to Terry on this before we return to the specifics of Davis Bessie. And Terry, you said you might have to leave. So I want to give you a chance to explain to our listeners exactly how people feel and what we know about First Energy and their concern for public safety and the public welfare. Do you want to say a few words about First Energy?
Before it was
remember, Terry, this is a family show, so.
Well, before it was First Energy, it was Toledo Edison and Cleveland Electric Illuminating, who were the partners in Davis Bessey. And thankfully, for people like Dennis Kucinich, who is congressman, as mayor of Cleveland, and later as congressman from the Cleveland area, he expended enormous time and effort trying to get the story out financially, from the safety and lack of regulation side of it. And there have been other opponents over the decades, too. What I think is that First Energy demonstrates the same callous disregard 35, 40 years after the plant has started operations, 40 years after the construction was so shabbily done that they didn't even paint the shield building, which was diagnosed as the cure that would fix everything in 2012, and did not, has now provably not stopped the cracking, and in fact may have even increased it. Incidentally, Harvey, if we do call the 2012 explanation of the blizzard of 78 the snow job, I'm starting to call the disclosure in 2015 of the 70% cracking and the 20% cracking in the second and third 25-foot bands from the top of the reactor building the band job.
There you go. So tell us about First Energy now. I actually have confronted Anthony Alexander in a hearing, the $8 million a year chair of First Energy. I think that's an understatement. But tell us just basically how First Energy stands out from the rest of the utility industry in this country.
Well, it was at First Energy that a decade ago, the blackout in what, the summer of 2005, 6, Kevin?
Oh, that was August 14th of 2003, because I was the only staffer at the NERS office. I remember it well.
Yeah, that was another system-wide maintenance failing by the utility company, which also was scored later, as I understood it, for not having adequately updated its various shutoff automated shutoff capabilities, and allowed the cascading failure of electricity to be delivered to most of the Northeast and this part of the Midwest.
It blocked out around 50 million people, right?
Second biggest power outage in human history.
And that was all really came out of Davis Bessey, right?
Correct.
They forgot to trim the trees. They didn't forget. They had no money to. They had hemorrhaged $600 million because of the hole in the head fiasco. That was in terms of replacement power costs for the 2-year shutdown. They were paying, you know, spot market high prices for electricity to replace Davis Bessey. Repairs, a record fine that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission charged them, $33.5 million. They had no money to trim the trees, and a branch touched a power line, and 50 million people lost electricity.
I think that was somewhere in the greater Cleveland area where that actually happened. But Harvey, what sort of brings it all home for me is that after decades of poor operation, of dangerous operation, of scary, scary incidents that are covered up until much later when we learn about them, now First Energy is in line for a big dabbling of corporate welfare. They want billions of dollars to keep two aging coal-fired plants and Davis Bessey fed and cared for until such time that they might actually become competitive. And they want shareholders to essentially be converted into ratepayers to be converted into shareholders and help bear the financial risks that the utility faces by keeping antiquated and, for that matter, in Davis Bessey's case, dangerous plants online.
Well, is it safe to say, I mean, I am not in the First Energy rate territory, but I have friends and relatives, and is it safe to say that First Energy is about as callous and uncaring and cynical a utility as exists on the face of the earth?
Well, it's hard to make that characterization of an entity that only exists on paper, but I would certainly wonder about some of its managers. They eagerly sacrificed a few engineers over the hole in the head incident that were actually, one might argue, trying to keep the plant operating under the most negative and ridiculous of conditions in the early 2000s. I think that there's an awful lot of cynicism when you basically are applying for a 20-year license extension to keep a plant open that continues to have this incredible, unprecedented cracking problem where internal engineers of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who are hardly ardent activists or radicals or anything, are criticizing the plant, the very foundation, the physical fundament of the blasted plant. I think that there are an awful lot of unanswered questions that things are not, they inevitably, because of aging, are not going to get better. They will only get worse. There will only be more problems. There will only be more foreseen or unforeseen difficulties.
We just learned last July that every time it freezes at Davis Bessie, in the fall, in the winter, in the spring, the cracking grows by as much as 0.7 inches every time it freezes. So the company's admitting over 5 inches of cracking growth in a typical year. So, you know, question gets begged, when is this thing just going to fall down of its own weight?
Oh, my God. I couldn't make this up, and I live in Ohio, for God's sakes. Terry White, can you stay with us, or you got to run?
I am going to have to leave in about 2 minutes.
All right, so give us 2 minutes to Terry Lodge, and we will continue with Kevin Camps after a short break. Terry, what do you want to say about David Spessy before you leave?
I think we have to shut it down. I have thought that very firmly for nearly 40 years and have been trying to work toward that end with a lot of other help and talent. But it is time for the American public, especially the regulating public in Ohio and other parts of the Midwest, to raise hell. I mean, are we going to actually keep this thing going just because it's there, as opposed to shifting gears and not allowing utilities to suck the oxygen out of the room?
All right, Terry Lodge, you're an attorney, right? So you've been on this case. How long have you been an intervener in the Davis Bessie situation?
My first intervention was about 1980 or 81, 1979.
All right, well, listen, thank you so much, Terry Lodge, for being with us. Kevin Camps, you're going to stay with us and continue. There's way much more to say about Davis Bessie and our move to shut it down, and you are working with Terry Lodge, so you can tell folks how to get in touch with him. We're going to take a short 3-minute break my buddy Dana Lyon singing the Solartopia song, and we'll be back with the great Kevin Camps in just 3 minutes.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home to me. Solartopia, that's the future for me. Green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere. Solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, or hydroplanes get you home in under an hour. Clean air, water, rooftop gardens, tidal geothermal power. Family, community, healthy children, and lots of forest for the bears. Solartopia.
All right, Dana, my buddy. Dana Lyon singing the Solartopia song. You want to see more of Dana Lyons, go to Cows with Guns. more than 2 million views on YouTube. It's the vegan vegetarian anthem. Fabulous. If you haven't seen it, make sure you go see the Cows with Guns video on YouTube with Dana Lyons. There are two versions, by the way, a cartoon version and a different one, and they're both fabulous. We are continuing here with Kevin Camps, the astonishing, you can, you know, as Yogi Berra said, you can't make this stuff up, things about the Davis-Besse nuclear plant. The reason I'm focusing on, I want to focus on Davis-Besse today, is that there is an opportunity to actually force the shutdown of Davis-Besse. It is losing money, and its owners, First Energy, who care about nothing but money, have gone in one of the supreme acts of American corporate chutzpah, and this takes a lot. They have gone to the Ohio Public Utilities Commission, and through a complicated set of manipulations, argued that they're arguing now that the ratepayers should be forced to fork over God knows how much money, hundreds of millions of dollars, to subsidize the continued operation of Davis-Besse. Now, I live in Central Ohio, and about a decade ago, the owners, First Energy, went in to the PUCO in front of the public and said, well, we want to deregulate the electric business in Ohio and have that wonderful thing, a free market in energy, which, of course, they wanted no such thing. But what they really did was want to get a ratepayer bailout for Davis-Besse and the Perry nuclear plant, which could not compete. And with a straight face, they went in to the legislature, actually, and they said, we want to have free competition, but before we do, you have to bring Perry and Davis-Besse up to par. We were forced, and they said this, they were forced by the public to build these nuclear plants, and they can't compete, they're too expensive. So we want to have free competition. We want you, the ratepayer, to be forced to pay billions of dollars to bring Perry and Davis-Besse up to par. And so they pulled this scam off with the legislature. We got deregulation, allegedly, a free market in energy, which was nonsense. And billions of dollars went to the utility companies to scam them in their scam for these nukes. And now they're turning around, First Energy is turning around and says, well, Davis-Besse can't compete. We need to have it subsidized. And therefore, you can all pay billions of dollars to subsidize this insanely dangerous commercial reactor, plus the one at Perry. And you can pay, two coal-burning power plants. And you can pay more to continue to operate this insanely dangerous nuclear plant. Now, if the PUCO turns them down, and we think they might actually, then we know that First Energy will go into the legislature and demand that electric utilities in Ohio be re-regulated. These are the people who always talk about free markets and blah, blah, blah. Adam Smith, who would be flipping in his grave over this one. And so there will be an evidentiary hearing. There have been public hearings already on Davis-Besse in northern Ohio, in Cleveland and Toledo, and there will be an evidentiary hearing in Columbus on, I believe it's April 22nd or 3rd, or a little earlier than that, maybe. And if we can stop, there are people who believe the PUCO is going to turn them down because it was illegal to do what they're asking to be done. And then Davis-Besse will go into the legislature, the First Energy, and demand that the legislature, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Koch brothers industries, re-regulate and force the ratepayers to pay for Davis-Besse. Meanwhile, this thing is crumbling, literally crumbling. Kevin Camps is with us. Kevin is with Beyond Nuclear. He's a Midwestern boy and knows Davis-Besse very, very well. So we, with the great Terry Lodge, we were proceeding with the Keystone Cops history of Davis-Besse. I'd like you to now, Kevin, if you would, tell us the story of the hole in the head. Sure. From 2002.
Yeah, and I should let you know that Tim Judson's trying to call in, but he's not getting a pickup.
Tim Judson from the Nuclear Information Resource Service.
He's trying to call in. But
tell him to email me his phone number, and I'll forward it on to the station, they'll tell him.
I will try to, you know, tell you about this hole in the head. It, you know, when you were asking Terry about, you know, describe this company. Some of the most powerful testimony came from the U.S. Department of Justice in the aftermath of the hole in the head. And I mentioned that the NRC issued the largest fine in its history. Still, it was $33.5 million that it fined First Energy. The Department of Justice had some things to say about First Energy's dishonesty and just chutzpah. And a part of that chutzpah had to do with a scam that First Energy, in the aftermath of the hole in the head, tried to play on its own insurance company. They told NRC one version of what had happened with the corrosion of the lid. They turned around and told their insurance provider the exact opposite in terms of the rate of the corrosion. You know, one version was it was very slow. How could we know it was happening? It was so subtle. The other version was, oh, it happened overnight. How could we possibly have known about it? It was over and done before we even knew it was happening. And they got busted. The insurance company was not willing to go there and ended up not paying the money that First Energy wanted paid to compensate it for this, you know, $600 million in replacement power and repairs and fines, you know. And so what happened was the coolant of the reactor core leaked through the lid, through these insertion points where control rods go down and control the nuclear reaction. And there's still, the jury's still out on why Davis Bessie is the hottest operating in terms of thermal temperature atomic reactor in the United States. Something about the design, something about how they're running it, but the increased pressure perhaps caused this leakage of boric acid solution from the coolant water in the core through these insertion points, and it leaked out on the top of the lid and ate its way down because the top of the lid is carbon steel. It's structural in nature, and there is a stainless steel liner. It's only 3/16 of an inch thick to prevent the boric acid in the core from eating its way out, and that's all that was left in this gaping hole that was about as big as a football. It was nearly 7 inches deep, and all that was left was this 3/16 inch layer of stainless steel that was bulging through that gap and soon to burst. And if it had burst, you would have had a loss of coolant accident in the core, no contingency. The cooling water under a ton of pressure per square inch would have instantly turned to steam, escaped the core completely, pretty fast-paced meltdown, probably through the bottom of the reactor pressure vessel, onto the floor of the containment. And as we've been talking about, you know, it's not just the walls of the shield building that are cracked. There's tremendous problems with degradation of the base of the shield building as well. So chances are, you know, if a meltdown happens at Davis Bessie, if one had happened because of the hole in the head, that meltdown is getting out. It's not going to be contained by the shield building.
Woof. Now, has anything like this that we know of happened at any other reactor in the world? Is this the only reactor, this Davis Bessie reactor near Toledo, is Ohio? Is this the only place where boric acid ate through the reactor pressure vessel there?
Well, this badly, anyway. There were other reactors having this problem, but nowhere near this bad. And in fact, it's what led to the discovery at Davis Bessie. And it really gets to the collusion between the nuclear industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, because other reactors of similar design, pressurized water reactors, were inspected by the NRC once this problem came up elsewhere in the country. But First Energy wanted to keep running the thing until the next scheduled refueling outage to maximize profits. And junior-level NRC safety engineers said, we need to inspect. And sure enough, in the aftermath, lots of evidence came out that the NRC had all kinds of indications that there was a problem at Davis Bessie, such as the fact that filters that are supposed to be changed once a month, air filters inside the containment area, were having to be changed daily. They were filling with airborne rust particles. So there was lots of evidence. There was a photo in the NRC files of lava-like substance coming off the lid. NRC knew something was going on. But the chairman of the agency, Richard Meserve, senior management like Sam Collins, allowed First Energy to continue operating, not do the inspection. And by the time they got around to doing the inspection, there was nearly a breach of the reactor pressure vessel.
You know, I have a really awful image of us somewhere down the road, you know, talking about this again after Davis Bessie has blown up. And, you know, this reactor is right there on the Lake Erie. And, you know, I live in Columbus. I would have loved, I would never take my kids to Lake Erie because I did not want them to be downwind from Davis Bessie. I mean, this place is just insane. And the idea that would allow it to be continue to operate, or even, and it's even more insane, to be subsidized by the ratepayers of Ohio to allow this thing to stay online when it's completely in non-competitive. And you know, in a free market, this reactor would be shut a decade ago. And now here's First Energy, who fought to have our electric utility grid deregulated so they could be such great competitors in the Adam Smith market, you know, to now come and say, well, you got to subsidize us is insane. We're joined by Tim Judson from Nuclear Information Resource Service. Tim, you with us?
Hi, Harvey. How are you?
Good. Glad you got through. Tell us, I don't know how much you've heard, but we have been running the Keystone Cop history here of the Davis Bessie nuclear plant in commemoration or in honor or in reaction to their assault on the rate structure in Ohio. And I want to invite you. Kevin is coming to Columbus in mid-April to join us. There's an evidentiary hearing at the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. People are not allowed to speak at this, but they can observe, and we will have a press event at the time. So I'd like to invite you to come to join Kevin here in Columbus and to deal with these guys. The date is actually the 13th. We'll probably do an event the evening of the 12th to get people together and have a dinner or something like that, and then we'll have a press event on the 13th as they open the evidentiary hearing.
Great.
And I'm going to you to join Kevin here in Columbus. So tell us, we have gone through, I don't know how much you've heard, but we have gone through the history up to the infamous hole in the head incident. Do you want to add anything to that? Or what has happened of note at Davis Bessie to add to this litany of insanity since the hole in the head incident?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that you guys have talked about the crack in the shield wall, and the faulty steam generators that had to be replaced and those sort of things. You know, I think that, you know, what you've got here, you know, is probably a case of systemic mismanagement at Davis Bessie. And, you know, what's really, I think, you know, remarkable about the fact that that First Energy is going to the Ohio PUC, and asking for this essentially ratepayer bailout, you know, is that this reactor is too expensive to continue operating, and the idea that they're going to basically put the ratepayers on the hook for whatever that might cost in order to keep Davis Bessie operational is absolutely insane. I mean, you know, what we're seeing right now is a wave of these kind of subsidy schemes taking shape across the Great Lakes region, both from Illinois all the way out to New York. And, where we're seeing this taking shape in New York right now on Lake Ontario is with the Ginna reactor near Rochester, where Exelon has, come begging to the Public Service Commission for yet another, nuclear plant that was deregulated and, is supposed to be able to, to make its, to be able to pay for itself on the merits of its own generation of electricity and selling it to the market. Exelon has come to the Public Service Commission in New York with basically a demand that ratepayers subsidize the continued operation of that reactor, which is actually even smaller than Davis Bessie, that is going to cost ratepayers at least $80 million a year in subsidies in above-market prices, and potentially as much as $150 million if Exelon gets what it's going to ask for in terms of a guaranteed rate of profit for a deregulated nuke. And I think, what we're seeing with Davis Bessie is something exactly similar, where ratepayers could be put on the dime for over $200 million a year in payments to First Energy for above market power prices from that reactor. I mean, this is outrageous, and what it really underlines is that sustainable energy options that could replace these nukes. You know, energy efficiency, wind and solar that are available, you know, online at, you know, at, you know, and the prices are declining, that we could be replacing these reactors with sustainable energy at lower than the cost of what these reactors are going to cost ratepayers going forward. And that really needs to be front and center in this debate, is that, you know, nuclear power is trying to sell itself into these bailout schemes by saying that it's zero carbon energy that's necessary to meet our climate goals, and exactly the opposite is true. It's actually going to hold us back, and it's going to cost us more money than it's worth. And we could be doing this more sustainably and cheaper, with better economic dividends, and you know, and more job creation, if we shut these things down and replace them with sustainable energy.
But Kevin Camps, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah. One thing I was going to ask, is it okay to give your listeners in Ohio the way to comment to the PUC?
Oh, absolutely. Please do.
Yeah, because Terry mentioned raising hell in Ohio, and that's what it's going to take to stop this thing. So folks, grab a pen and paper or whatever. One way you can make comments to the Ohio Public Utilities Commission is by email, and the email address is docketing@puc.state.oh.us. And you need to put in the subject line, and probably in the body of the email as well, this label, so they know where to route it. You need to write opposition comment under case number 14-1297-EL-SSO. And I can get to that, Harvey, maybe to attach to the announcement of the show. But
yeah,
that's what we're trying
to
do,
me,
is
I'll,
just rally I'll the troops and get as many comments in. What we've done in this public comment session, you mentioned the hearings in Akron and Toledo and Cleveland, where other national groups like Public Citizen testified in Cleveland. What we've done ourselves, our coalition intervening against Davis Bessie's license extension, is we've submitted to the PUCO all of our filings in the proceeding with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensing panel, dating back to December of 2010. And so we've had dozens of contentions, especially about the severe and worsening cracking of the shield building. Because as Michael Keegan of Don't Waste Michigan puts it, he's one of the interveners just across Lake Erie from Davis Bessie, you know, Ohio ratepayers should not be forced to buy a pig in a poke. This is a pig in a poke. This is a shield building that they have kept a lot of secrets about, despite all the headlines. You know, we just found out in July about this ice wedging crack propagation dynamic, where every time it freezes, the cracks grow 0.7 inches. They kept that secret for years. That's like a criminal cover-up that they're not being held accountable for. The NRC just doesn't care.
Wow. Tim Judson, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting about the shield wall issue is that it's basically the exact same type of issue that closed the Crystal River 3 reactor permanently last year or 2 years ago. You know, the company who operated it had damaged the containment doing a steam generator replacement, you know, like what Davis Bessie's got to do. And, you know, through a series of mishaps, basically, you know, revealed that it was going to cost them over $1 billion to replace to repair the containment at Crystal River 3, and then the PUC in Florida basically said that they weren't going to allow it, and the operator had to make the decision to close the reactor down. What FirstEnergy is trying to create through this subsidy scheme that they're applying to the PUC for in Ohio, essentially seems to me like they're going to create a black box where whatever the operating costs of Davis Bessie are going forward, ratepayers are going to have to pay for it and not have the same kind of review that they would have in a state where reactors are really regulated. And so you could end up having, you know, Davis Bessie throwing billions of dollars down the drain trying to fix this shield wall, and the ratepayers are just going to have to pay it and not have any oversight.
And you know what, here we went a whole hour and we didn't even get to the fact that the steam generators that were just installed at Davis Bessie are illegal and don't meet the basis on which they were installed, very similar to at San Onofre, resulted in the shutdown of the San Onofre nuclear power plants, the two reactors there. We could go on another 5 hours about Davis Bessie. I just hope, you two guys, that we are not going to have a show in the near future talking about how Davis Bessie blew up. I think we need to get this thing shut. I am terrified of Davis Bessie. It is the Al-Qaeda of American reactors, and I hope we get it down as soon as possible. We're almost out of time. Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, I'm sorry you had trouble. We'll have you back another time. Next week I'm going to have on Kevin Helen Caldicott. But we'll, in a week or two after that, we'll have you guys back, and we'll talk further about the five reactors in Illinois and the one in New York that we is on the brink of shutdown. Tim, real quick, your website?
Yeah, sure. www.nirs.org.
And Kevin Camp?
Yeah, ours is beyondnuclear.org.
All right, guys, we'll see you again. This has been the Solar Topia Green Power and Wellness Show. Looking forward to shutting down the Davis Bessie reactors next week. Helen Caldicott, thank you, the crew in New York, and we'll be back in Solartopia.
To pay the cost, and so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.